most capable political cadre this side of the border.
To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org. All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
It's 8 o'clock in New York City at 99.5 FM WBAI, listener-sponsored commercial-free radio. Coming up next, Democracy Now!
From New York, this is Democracy Now! At least five people are dead in Beirut after snipers opened fire on a protest. The violence comes as Lebanon faces a devastating economic crisis. Over the weekend, Lebanon fell into darkness for 24 hours after the nation's electric grid collapsed. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Plus, we look at the ongoing probes into Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. The House January 6th committee has subpoenaed former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark days after the Senate revealed Trump directly asked the DOJ nine times for help to overturn the election.
This president, former President Donald Trump, would have shredded the Constitution to keep his office in the presidency.
And we look at how an Afghan interpreter who helped rescue Joe Biden in 2008 has finally escaped from Afghanistan with his family. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's announced plans to keep the Port of Los Angeles open around the clock in order to battle a global supply chain crisis that's idled container ships off the coast, driving up prices on food, fuel, and consumer goods. The move will double the number of hours the port will remain open to relieve unprecedented supply chain bottlenecks.
This is across-the-board commitment to going to 24/7. This is a big first step in speeding up the movement of materials and goods through our supply chain. But now we need the rest of the private sector chain to step up as well.
The Labor Department reported Wednesday the consumer price index rose by 5.4% in September compared to 1 year prior, partly driven by supply chain problems caused by the pandemic. To keep pace with inflation, the Social Security Administration said Wednesday it would boost benefits by nearly 6% next year. The World Health Organization announced a new expert panel that will investigate the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. The advisory body will include 26 scientists from around the world, including one expert from the U.S. and one from China. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the panel will also investigate the origins of future outbreaks.
The emergence of new viruses with the potential to spark epidemics and pandemics is a fact of nature. And while SARS-CoV-2 is the latest such virus, it will not be the last.
In South Africa, protesters gathered outside the embassies of the United States and several European countries demanding they break a stalemate at the World Trade Organization and suspend patent rights on COVID vaccines. The so-called TRIPS waiver was first proposed by India and South Africa over a year ago and is primarily opposed by the UK, Germany, and Switzerland. The group MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, which joined the protests, says a handful of European governments with strong ties to pharmaceutical corporations are choosing to put shareholder interests above the lives of people across the globe. MSF added, quote, the U.S. made a big, bold decision to support this groundbreaking TRIPS waiver, but is now largely absent from the global effort to make it a reality, unquote. Meanwhile, a dozen Democratic U.S. lawmakers are calling on the Biden administration to share Moderna's COVID vaccine technology with other countries to expand global vaccine production. The lawmakers note that a contract between Moderna and the federal government grants the U.S. unlimited rights to vaccine data, including all key information needed to produce Moderna's vaccine. The lawmakers add, quote, despite receiving huge sums of public funding from American taxpayers, Moderna has refused calls to share its technology, including from the U.S. government, unquote. The United States reported nearly 1,900 new COVID-19 deaths Wednesday. More than 62,000 people remain hospitalized with the disease. In Florida, the Department of Health has levied a $3.5 million fine on Leon County after officials there required employees to show proof of vaccination. Several other county governments, school districts, and businesses are under scrutiny for defying a ban on vaccine mandates imposed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. This comes as a new study by the Kaiser Family Foundation finds the U.S. could have prevented 90,000 deaths over the last 4 months if more adults had been vaccinated. The Biden administration's announced plans to build large-scale wind farms along most of the continental U.S. coastline. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said Wednesday the U.S. will auction off leases to wind energy developers in waters off the coasts of California, Oregon, the Carolinas, as well as in the central Atlantic, Gulf of Maine, and Gulf of Mexico. The Biden administration hopes to see the U.S. produce 30,000 megawatts of electricity from offshore wind farms by 2030. A new report by the International Energy Agency finds commitments by world governments to cut carbon emissions are nowhere near what's needed to avert climate catastrophe. The IEA is calling on governments to move decisively to cut emissions in half by 2030, far faster than what countries have pledged under the Paris Climate Agreement. In Washington, D.C., another 90 climate activists were arrested outside the White House Wednesday, demanding President Biden take real action to halt the climate crisis. This is Anthony Lorenzo Green, a Washington, D.C. community organizer and city council candidate.
We must repair the harm caused by environmental racism. That means we must have a world that no longer bows to the coal, oil, and gas industries that have a long history of poisoning our land and rivers. I know climate change is real because I live in a community where homes flood every year.
Texas's Republican-controlled House of Representatives has approved a heavily gerrymandered redistricting map that severely diminishes the voting power of Black and Latinx communities while giving a disproportionate share of power to white voters. Final passage came at around 3:30 a.m. local time in Austin, capping 14 hours of debate. Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman tweeted in response, quote, democracy is quite literally dying in the dark. The conservative-led U.S. Supreme Court appeared in favor of reinstating the death penalty for Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev after hearing arguments in the case Wednesday. A federal appeals court overturned the execution last year, but Biden's Justice Department is arguing to bring back his death sentence. Conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioned the motivations of the federal government during the hearing.
I'm wondering what the government's end game is here. So the government has declared a moratorium on executions, but you're here defending his death sentences. And if you win, presumably that means that he is relegated to living under threat of a death sentence that the government doesn't plan to carry out.
During the 2020 presidential campaign, Joe Biden pledged to work toward eliminating federal capital punishment. In Lebanon, heavy gunfights are ongoing in some of the worst violence Beirut has seen in a decade. Earlier today, at least five people were killed, multiple others injured, after gunfire erupted during a Hezbollah-led protest calling for the removal of Judge Tariq Bitar from the investigation into last August's devastating blast at the port of Beirut. The explosion killed more than 200 people. Critics accuse the judge of bias. It's unclear who fired the shots at the protesters after headlines. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. In the Czech Republic, voters have defeated strongman populist Prime Minister Andrej Babiš in weekend elections after opposition parties formed alliances that received a majority of parliamentary seats. The scandal-ridden billionaire Babiš has attacked refugees and more recently appeared in the Pandora Papers, which expose the covert financial dealings of politicians and other global elites. In Norway, a 37-year-old Danish man used a bow and arrow to attack people in a small town west of Oslo Wednesday, killing five people and wounding two others. Police described the suspect as a Muslim convert who'd previously been flagged for radicalization, but authorities say the motivation for the attack is still unknown, that he's thought to have acted alone. Wednesday's attack prompted police across Norway to carry firearms. Norwegian police are usually unarmed. It was Norway's worst attack since a far-right white supremacists killed 77 people a decade ago. Over 10,000 workers at John Deere farm equipment plants across the Midwest United States went on strike at midnight to fight for fair wages, pension benefits for all workers, and good working conditions. Members of the United Auto Workers overwhelmingly rejected a proposed contract and say they'll continue bargaining with the company until all their demands are met. In other labor news, tens of thousands of Kaiser Permanente employees in California and Oregon have voted to authorize a strike amid stalled contract negotiations over pay and working conditions. Health workers say the pandemic had led to mental health concerns and severe staff shortages. This comes as some 60,000 film and TV workers with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IATSE, could go on strike starting Monday if no deal is reached in the coming days to address the industry's low wages and overworking of crews. This is Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO, of which IATSE is a member union.
We're fighting for the weekend, as I said earlier. I mean, it's 2021, and yet, and these people are working overtime. They're, you know, answering the call, and yet the companies now, who are making pretty tidy profits, suddenly can't pay overtime.
Yeah.
And suddenly you can't have a meal break.
Right.
And you're ending your shift on a Friday night and are being called back Saturday morning with less than 8 hours of time in between.
Many are referring to this month as Striketober due to the massive wave of work stoppages that are expected or are already underway. Meanwhile, workers at a dollar store in Connecticut and multiple Starbucks locations in Buffalo, New York, are organizing to form the first unions at their respective workplaces. This week, Starbucks announced it's closing two of the Buffalo stores being unionized. The company called the move a coincidence. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we're beginning today's show looking at the growing economic and political crisis in Lebanon. Earlier today, at least five people died, over 30 were wounded in Beirut after snipers attacked a protest where demonstrators were calling for the removal of the judge investigating last year's deadly port explosion. Today's protest was in part organized by Hezbollah. Clashes continued in the streets of Beirut for hours after the snipers first opened fire. The deadly attack comes just days after Lebanon's state-run electrical grid collapsed, resulting in a 24-hour nationwide blackout. While electricity has been partially restored, much of the country still faces long stretches without power. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is confronting one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Its currency has collapsed. There are massive food and fuel shortages. Almost three-quarters of the population live in poverty. And Lebanon is facing a political crisis as investigations continue into last year's port explosion, which killed at least 215 people and destroyed entire neighborhoods of Beirut. We go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Lara Bitar. She's editor-in-chief of The Public Source, a Beirut-based independent media organization. Lara, welcome to Democracy Now! Just explain what's happening to Lebanon.
This morning that are ongoing, there's a short lull right now. Residents are being evacuated from their homes, so our children from their school. As you correctly stated, snipers, unidentified still to this point, fired at a demonstration that was being organized by Hezbollah and their allies, the Amal movement. These two political parties have been trying to unseat the lead investigative judge, Judge Tariq Bitar, from the investigation into the port explosion.
Lara, could you explain who the judge is and why there's such opposition to him carrying out this investigation?
So I think far beyond the intricacies and the details of this investigation in particular, Lebanon has a very long history since the civil war and in the aftermath of unresolved political assassinations, bombings, a myriad of and different types of violences that are carried out every once in a while, sporadic clashes, and oftentimes, or not to say all the time, we are unable to identify the culprits. We are unable to attain any sort of justice. And these acts continue to be carried on with complete impunity. There is never any accountability. And this tone was set in the aftermath of the civil war, when warlords, now politicians, continued kind of the same mechanisms and these same power struggles. So whenever we have these outbursts or clashes, bits and bouts of violence that take place in the city and outside of the city, it's really just the continuation of these decades-long power struggles between varied political forces, for the most part right-wing forces that are just struggling for power amongst each other. And moments of calm, it's when we have these national unity governments, and these national unity governments are for the most part characterized by these same political parties that in essence gang up on the population to divide the spoils amongst each other. As far as this judge is concerned, he is the second judge to have been assigned to carry out this task. The judge that preceded him, Judge Sawan, was forced to resign. And we later found out that he was receiving a lot of death threats, and he was not able to carry out the duty that he was tasked with. The allegation or the claim of Hezbollah and their allies is that this investigation is being politicized, that the United States and their local partners in Lebanon are trying to exploit the investigation. A couple of days ago, they kind of inferred that this judge was leaning towards incriminating Hezbollah, the party of God. So this is a part of the reason why there's this attack on this investigation. But again, it's very important to note that right now it's the Hezbollah who's trying to impede an investigation in any form of justice, but all of the political parties and all of the political figures that have been ruling this country over the past few decades are just as guilty.
And Lara, could you explain the broader context, both economic and humanitarian, in which this is occurring, both the investigation as well as this sniper attack today? We gave some of the figures in our introduction, and now the World Food Program saying that food prices have gone up by 628%. In the last 2 years, the Lebanese pound having lost 90% of its value, three-quarters of the population, as we mentioned, almost three-quarters, living in poverty. And you've said that Lebanon's economy is basically based on debt. Could you explain how this situation came about and how successive Lebanese governments are largely responsible?
Definitely. Nermeen, if you'll allow me first, I would just like to correct the record on one thing, because we at the Public Source put out a special issue on the first commemoration of the August blast, and we combed through unofficial lists, official lists, media reports, talked to the families of the victims of the blast, and what we found out is that 252 people were killed in the blast, not as widely reported, over 200. To kind of portray the Lebanese state's failures on one hand, but complete negligence and disregard for human lives and the cost of the blast and other explosions and fires that have taken place since, the Lebanese Health Ministry stopped updating the list of casualties shortly after the blast took place and only accounts for 191 victims, whereas people are still dying from the blast. And as a matter of fact, one pharmacist died exactly 1 year after the blast on August 4, 2021, so just a few months ago. So to get back to your question, Lebanon right now is experiencing one of the most devastating economic crisis that not only that the region has seen, but the world. And as stated in the World Bank report, 79% of the population is living underneath the poverty line. This is up from close to 25 to 30% just 3 years ago. The situation for Syrian, Palestinian, and other refugees who live in Lebanon and have been living here for quite a while is even more disastrous, with figure reaching up to 90%. So over the past 2 years, we've been experiencing severe power outages. The nationwide power outage that took place last week was not exceptional. And as a matter of fact, it was surprising to most of us because we found out that there was a power outage through the media. It was not something that most people noticed. This is how bad the electricity situation is in Lebanon right now. Before the nationwide power outage that took place, most people were only being supplied with an hour of electricity a day, two at most. So this is obviously impacting our access to water. Our access to water, our access to drinking water as well. And obviously, due to the shortages in fuel, diesel, and so on, there are frequent disruptions to the internet, frequent disruption to all telecommunication services. And we've also been faced since the beginning of the summer with recurring shortages in petrol, the subsidies on which have recently been lifted. So the situation across the board is disastrous. Public sector employee wages have been decimated. The education provided by public schools and the only public university, the Lebanese University, is at risk. It's not clear yet if there's going to be another school year. And pretty much access to any basic services, commodities, basic goods is extremely difficult for the vast majority of the population.
Can you respond to the World Bank saying Lebanon is in one of the worst economic collapses in the last 150 years? A bit further, explain.
So let me answer that question by talking about the formation of the most recent government spearheaded by billionaire Prime Minister Najib Miati. Najib Miati is basically tasked with doing one thing, in my opinion, which is, obviously to resume negotiations with the IMF. Going back to the earlier question about the economy of Lebanon being based on debt, what led us to this situation today is exactly this economy that is non-productive in any shape or form, that is reliant almost exclusively on remittances from abroad, that is also reliant to a certain extent on the service industry. But for the most part, the economy of Lebanon is non-productive at all. So over the past 30 years, it has been dependent almost exclusively on these loans from the IMF, from the World Bank, from the international community in general. And this is really what got us into this disastrous situation to begin with. So going back to Prime Minister Najib Miati, he's tasked with resuming these negotiations with the IMF, with further indebting the country and the population for generations to come. And the World Bank really and the IMF and the international community at large has a lot of responsibility in what's happening with Lebanon. And in my opinion, the eventual bailout that will happen, which is really a bailout of the banks, similar to what happened in the United States in 2008 after the financial crisis there. We are hearing a lot of talk about selling off what remains of state assets, of further decimating the public sector, of basically killing off what remains of this country and eliminating any possibility for, on one hand, political change, economic change, and on the other, social change. And again, I must emphasize that the international community holds a huge responsibility in constantly allowing the political class to reproduce itself, of throwing it a lifeline, whatever it is in crisis, and of preventing really the will of the people to be assumed.
Can you talk about the role right now of COVID and how it's affecting the population and also the victims of the Beirut port blast holding a sit-in at the Palace of Justice?
So the families of the victims and people who were injured, almost 10,000 people were injured, over 1,000 permanently disabled or maimed, they have not been receiving any kind of help from the Ministry of Health or anybody else. They've been left to fend off on their own because of the depreciation of the Lebanese pound by over 90%. They are unable to pay for their surgeries. They are unable to pay for their medication. And even medication, the most basic, are missing, and there are severe shortages. What this economic crisis has created is a two-tier society. Lebanon has always been a vastly unequal country, but the economic crisis has allowed a small minority of people to exploit the crisis and make vast amounts of money. One of the ways in which they've done that is through the subsidies program that was mismanaged, that was exploited and abused by a certain class of people. And this has happened, of course, at the expense of the majority of the population that is continuously sinking deeper into poverty. The minimum wage right now is less than $40 per month. And to talk a little bit about COVID, the mismanagement of the vaccination program was really what was expected. The Lebanese public, the Lebanese Ministry of Health decided to buy some of the most expensive vaccines by using some of the World Bank loan that they had received as part of this resilience program, about $40 million, $32 million of which were used for the vaccination program. Less than 19% of the population is fully vaccinated, and the program in general was in complete disarray, mismanaged. Some people were allowed to cut the line ahead of others who should have been prioritized. Taxi drivers, people with disabilities, some of the most vulnerable of the population were placed at the end of the line. But then we saw, of course, government officials at the very front, and this outraged a lot of people when it happened. And I assume that one of the reasons that Lebanon hasn't been hit by the Delta variant as hard as other countries have is because simply because so many people have already been infected. Granted, the number is around 700,000 people who were infected, but of course it's fair to assume that the number is significantly higher since testing has drastically reduced over the past few months, and the COVID-19 pandemic is not really so much on the agenda anymore.
Lara, could you talk about the broader health context in which this COVID pandemic is playing out in Lebanon? I mean, quite apart from the absence or mismanagement of vaccination, they're also basic, the most basic medicine is not available, and hospitals and clinics are on the verge of collapse. If you could respond to that, explain what's happening, and also elaborate on your earlier point about the international community's complicity in the present situation. If you could explain what you mean by that and what you think needs to happen.
Sure. So I'll start first by addressing the health crisis in Lebanon. As you stated, most of the even generic medications are not available in pharmacies anymore. And people who have access to what is now referred to as fresh dollars could potentially buy some of this medication off of the black market at exorbitant prices. But again, for the overwhelming majority, it's very difficult to access life-saving medication. A few weeks ago, cancer patients held a sit-in because they have been prevented from continuing their treatment for quite a while. They haven't been able to access the medication that they need. Right now, honestly, it's a gamble to be living in Lebanon, because you don't know if you get into a car accident, if you're going to be transported to the hospital, whether they're going to have the basic tools, the basic medication that you might need. At the same time, there's also an exodus of medical workers. Doctors and nurses, just like everybody else who has the ability to do so, are fleeing the country in droves. So this is putting, another burden on the sector. And finally, on that point, the social security system here in Lebanon is near bankruptcy. Almost a million people rely on the service to visit their doctor or to carry out, to have any procedure, any surgery, to get their medications as well. Now, this social security service has been almost incapable of responding to the needs of people who rely on these services. As for my point on the international community, so what I meant by that is in 2019, there were mass demonstrations against this political class. The demand was pretty simple. It was a complete rejection of what this political class has been doing to this country for decades, how they're ruling it, how they're exploiting every industry, every sector, and how they're constantly reinforcing their sectarian clientelist networks in order to stay in power. And this is not to say that these mass demonstrations or that the uprising that we witnessed in 2019 and early 2020 saw a very clear pathway and that they were going to topple this political and economic system. But for a brief period of time, people felt like change could be possible, maybe not in the near future, but at a certain point. The French in particular, led by the French President Macron, who had this initiative, who was really playing a hero in the aftermath of the explosion, and was constantly coming to Beirut and making statements, promised kind of that no aid would be given to the Lebanese government without reforms. Now, we all know what reforms mean. Reforms mean further privatization. Reforms at a certain point will, of course, mean even harsher austerity measures and a reform that is in the benefit of the banking sector in Lebanon that is very powerful and that has a lot of sway in a lot, if not most, of the political decisions that are made by this establishment. Lebanon or the Lebanese government and this political class would not be able to sustain itself without the financial assistance of countries like France and others. This political class that is now preparing itself for elections next year would not be able to finance these elections and bribe people, with the basic goods and services, had it not been for the financial assistance of the international community.
We want to thank you, Lara Bitar, editor-in-chief of The Public Source, a Beirut-based independent media organization, speaking to us from Lebanon. Coming up, we're going to look at how an Afghan interpreter who helped rescue Joe Biden in 2008 has finally escaped with his family from Afghanistan. Stay with us.
Thank you.
of a Dying City by the Lebanese musician Rabia Boukhalil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh, an Afghan interpreter who helped rescue then-Senator Joe Biden when he was stranded 13 years ago in Afghanistan in 2008, made headlines this week when the Wall Street Journal reported he and his family have finally escaped Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated by the United States and its allies between the Taliban takeover and the end of official evacuation efforts on August 30th. Many were left behind, including those who'd worked for the U.S. government and military. A day after the U.S. evacuations ended, Aman Khalili, who worked as an interpreter with the U.S. Army, made a public plea to Biden in the Wall Street Journal. "Save me and my family," he said. Just before we went to air today, Khalili described to Democracy Now! His journey out of the country with his family.
So this is Aman Khalili. Khalili, I am talking with you from Doha, Qatar. And we start our travel from Afghanistan. It took us 144 hours driving non-stop to reach in Islamabad. There was a guy contacted me in the city of Kabul, and he drove me from my house to an safe house. I was in the safe house for 15 days. Then after 15 days, he called me, "Please be ready, we are going to move you up to north of Afghanistan." So and we come back from north by another team to Helmand province. We start our travel from Helmand to the border of Pakistan. We had a point of contact there. We reached into the house. There was a desert. There was no bushes, no human, no animals. It was a sand. There was another team. They helped me and my family, and we took us to another one to start our travel to Islamabad. It took 14 hours drive by high speed, and there was a lot of checkpoints.
That's Aman Khalili speaking from Doha, Qatar, where he and his family are now after their long trip out of Afghanistan. For more on how it happened and the latest on others trying to escape, we're joined by the Wall Street Journal reporter Diane Nissenbaum. He broke the story. Afghan interpreter who helped rescue Joe Biden in 2008 escapes Afghanistan. Thanks so much for joining us from Brussels. Can you start off by just laying out the whole journey and what took place and exactly who he was working for at the time?
Sure. Aman works for a contractor that worked, that provided interpreters to the U.S. military. He joined right after the U.S. toppled the government in 2001, worked for the U.S. military in a variety of capacities for many years. And in 2008, he was working with the Arizona National Guard unit that was part of the rescue to save Joe Biden, Chuck Hagel, and John Kerry, who were on this this fact-finding mission. He was left behind. As you know, there were tens of thousands of people like Aman who were trying to get out. This Army National Guard unit contacted me in the waning days of the evacuation and said, "Aman's being left behind. He was part of this special mission." And he made that emotional appeal to the president, which in fact led to, you know, the officials in the White House and Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, saying, "We will get you out. We will honor your commitment." But in fact, the U.S. government was fairly limited in its ability to get him out after they withdrew their forces. And so the effort to get him out fell to this mishmash of private groups that have been working in the past few weeks to get people like Aman out. And so everybody from Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, the notorious founder of Blackwater, whom you know well, Glenn Beck, the conservative commentator who was flying Christians out and other at-risk people, they both stepped up. They tried to help. Eric Prince offered to carry out a clandestine evacuation to get him out of the country, to fly him out. Glenn Beck worked for a couple of weeks to try and get him on a charter. But the problem was that the Taliban weren't allowing people out, Afghans out, that didn't have passports, and most of Aman's family didn't have that. So eventually, Aman and the Arizona National Guard folks that were helping him turned to an Afghan-American interpreter who also worked in the military, who has been quietly getting people out across the border by land through these routes through Helmand. And it's a very risky effort. It took many days. It took weeks for them to work out this effort. And what it shows is how difficult it is for people like Aman, who have the White House at their back, to get out right now when the Taliban are posing so many restrictions.
Can you mentioned Blackwater. Can you go back to 2008 when then Senator Joe Biden was saved when his helicopter went down in that snowstorm with John Kerry? And who it was who was guarding him, the significance of that moment right after Nisour Square, the deadly assault by Blackwater in Iraq, of course, in another country where they opened fire and gunned down so many people in a intersection in Iraq.
Yeah, to me, this is sort of one of the more fascinating elements. This is kind of this quintessential end of war story here, because in 2008, Blackwater held the State Department contract to provide diplomatic security to people like Joe Biden that were visiting the country. So in 2008, Blackwater was providing personal protection for these three senators as they were on this fact-finding mission and on these two helicopters, and they were flying back to Bagram Air Base from another base in eastern Afghanistan. They hit this snowstorm, whiteout conditions, they have to land in this valley. And so you had a Blackwater team that was providing personal protection for the three senators, and then they had the army that was obviously providing protection for the general that was with them and for the transport in Afghanistan. So Blackwater was providing security. This was just months after Blackwater's security in Baghdad had killed 17 people in Nisour Square. And so it was a polarizing event. I just thought it fascinating. I don't even think that the senators at the time knew that Blackwater was providing them security, but there they were, and Eric Prince was, boasting about saving Joe Biden in his biography, and then when the withdrawal was happening, and then he popped up again to try and offer to save them again. At the time, over the last few weeks of the withdrawal from Afghanistan in August, Eric Prince was offering seats on charter planes for upwards of $6,000 or more, and never got very many people out. He got maybe one charter out, if that, but he was one of those people that was making a lot of offers to help people that fell through.
Dion, as you mentioned earlier, Aman Khalili had a rather curious and improbable alliance of groups working to get him out of Afghanistan following the Wall Street Journal report. Refugee groups, the conservative commentator Glenn Beck, as you mentioned, together with Eric Prince and Blackwater in general. Could you explain why you think that his case generated such widespread interest among these groups that wouldn't necessarily be aligned, in particular refugee groups and other humanitarian organizations that were working also for him to escape, and the fact that there's such a large number of people, I mean tens of thousands as you document in your own coverage, who are waiting to leave Afghanistan, who are also at grave danger and, needless to say, do not have the support of these groups?
Yeah. I think this story resonated with me as a journalist, and I think with so many people, because the bottom line is that this is an Afghan interpreter who helped save Joe Biden in 2008, who was being left behind by President Joe Biden as he was withdrawing from Afghanistan, and he made a personal plea for help. And I think it was just a personal story about someone that directly helped the president who now needed the president's help. And the fact that it took so many groups trying so many different ways, and with the White House directly trying to help, shows the difficulty that these tens of thousands of other people that are still in hiding and still trying to get out face. There are still Americans that are trying to get out. There are still the family members of U.S. service members who are trying to get out. There are still high-profile judges, lawmakers. I get emails every day from people looking for help, and you know the ways out are incredibly narrow right now. You need a passport. You need help, and you have just a whole variety of people that are carrying out quietly heroic operations, you know, every day, getting people out through Iran onto Greece, getting people out through Pakistan, trying to organize these charter flights. And, you know, there are just so many people that need help, like Aman. He's representative of a group of people that still are appealing for help from America and anybody else that can help them.
I was wondering if you could comment on The Intercept, which recently published a piece titled "The CIA's Afghan Proxies Accused of War Crimes Will Get a Fresh Start in the U.S. Andrew Quilty and Matthew Cole write, quote, "The CIA prioritized the evacuation of zero unit members from Afghanistan, flying out as many as 7,000 of the former commandos and their relatives, even as thousands of vulnerable former U.S. government and military employees, human rights activists and aid workers were left behind. Most coverage of the CIA's efforts has been laudatory, but the zero units were known for deadly night raids that killed an untold number of civilians across Afghanistan. The Intercept documented 10 raids conducted by in Wardak province, southwest of Kabul, in which at least 51 civilians, including children, were killed, many at close range in execution-style assaults. Your response, Diane?
Yeah, certainly those CIA units have been very controversial for a long time. The intelligence agencies were running their own efforts. During the last weeks of the withdrawal, I didn't have much visibility on what they were doing, for sure. And the withdrawal was incredibly chaotic. You know, there's so much criticism of the way the U.S. government handled getting people out, and so many people have been left behind that are still deserving of getting out of the country. And I know that people are counting on the White House commitment to help them beyond what they're doing right now. The U.S. government is very limited in what it can do. I know that there are a lot of people that would like to see them do more to help those that have been left behind, and to continue to honor the commitment of those that are stuck.
And Diane, before we conclude, I'd like to ask about what the present political and humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is. Just last week on Friday, there was an attack on a Shiite mosque in which several people were killed. The Islamic State claimed responsibility, and the Taliban has blamed the U.S. For the increasing presence of the Islamic State in Afghanistan. If you could comment on that, and also on the humanitarian crisis in the country. The U.N. has estimated a million children now are at the risk of starvation.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation right now. I think the world is still trying to figure out when and how to directly interact with the Taliban government. The UN continues to provide support. There are so many uncertainties right now. People are watching the Taliban closely for how they are dealing with the economic situation, with treatment of women, with treatment of people that worked for the previous government and worked for the U.S., you know, these are essentially all unanswered questions. As you all know, the world often turns the page quickly, turns to other crises as they pop up, and Afghanistan is one of these places that pops up for a while and then is forgotten, and people there still need much help.
Well, you can rest assured we won't forget. Diane Nissenbaum is a Wall Street Journal reporter focused on U.S. policy and Middle East. His Wall Street Journal report headlined, "Afghan interpreter who helped rescue Joe Biden in 2008 escapes Afghanistan." When we come back, we look at probes into Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election in 30 seconds. The Zora Orchestra, Afghanistan's first all-female orchestra. Members of the group, along with the Afghanistan National Institute of Music, escaped from the Taliban as were taken to Qatar earlier this month. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection subpoenaed former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, whom Donald Trump considered installing as Attorney General in the final weeks of his presidency because he supported subverting the election. This comes as information continues to come out about Trump's extraordinary efforts to stay in the White House after losing to Joe Biden. The Senate Judiciary Committee recently revealed Trump directly asked the Justice Department 9 times for help to overturn the election. The Senate report states Trump's efforts to use DOJ as a means to overturn the election results was part of his interrelated efforts to retain the presidency by any means necessary, unquote. One of Trump's lawyers, John Eastman, also wrote a 2-page memo detailing how Trump could essentially stage a coup by getting the electors from 7 states thrown out, preventing Biden from winning enough electoral votes. On Wednesday, former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen testified in private for 8 hours before the House subcommittee investigating the January 6th insurrection. The committee's preparing to file criminal charges as soon as today if former Trump advisor Steve Bannon misses a deadline to testify and hand over documents. Bannon's been pardoned by President Trump. We're joined now by John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. His latest article, Trump's coup attempt is far from finished. Explain why people should care right now, John Nichols, as, of course, President Trump is not president anymore.
You're right. He is not president anymore, although he certainly tried to remain as president. And we're getting more and more evidence of that. People should care because there's very little doubt at this point that Donald Trump is preparing to run for president in 2024. He was in Iowa over the weekend, and you couldn't look at that rally, that event, with all of the state Republican leadership and senior member of the U.S. Senate, Chuck Grassley, present, and not know that this was preparation for a presidential run in the first caucus state in the country. So that's number one. We know that Trump is going to run for president again, or at least we can make that assumption. Number two, he has taken full control of the Republican Party. It is absurd to suggest at this point that Donald Trump doesn't have top-to-bottom control of the party at the national level and, frankly, in most of the states. And so he will, if he runs, be the Republican nominee for president of the United States in 2024. And then finally, if he is the Republican nominee, even if he loses, we know from his past behavior that on election night or the next morning, he will declare that he won and the only thing that stood in his way was fraud. And because of this increasing control over the Republican Party, because of this increasing acceptance within the Republican Party at the state level of this big lie approach, we really are looking at the prospect that Trump will seek to implement exactly the strategy that he was trying to implement before January 6th, again in 2024.
John Nichols, you've argued that, of course, Trump was impeached, but he should have been convicted. If he had been convicted, of course, he would have been prevented from running for another term. But could he have been convicted?
Well, this is the very interesting question, because as all of this new information comes out, Nermeen, what we're starting to see is that the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate did not have all of the evidence about Donald Trump's wrongdoing. What we now know is that he abused his position in ways that are jaw-dropping. The pressure that he put on the Department of Justice, the clear strategy that he had developed to get the Department of Justice to say that it was investigating fraud, and then to use that statement to get state legislatures that are under Republican control to send alternative slates of electors, was clearly part of an overall plan to upend the election results and to retain the presidency. That might, I would say might, have had an impact on at least some Republican senators and might have led to a conviction. But you didn't get the conviction. What you got instead was 57 senators, the largest number in history, voting to convict a president who had, or former president at that point, who had committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Now the question is, can we do anything going forward?
I want to turn to Donald Trump speaking on the John Solomon Reports podcast earlier this month.
The insurrection took place on November 3rd. That was the insurrection when they rigged the election. The big insurrection, the real insurrection, really the crime of the century, that took place on November 3rd and not on January 6th.
The real insurrection was Election Day. John Nichols, the significance of this and the point that the voting rights attorney, Mark Elias, makes, that there are so many voter suppression laws that are passing around the country right now to make it extremely difficult, particularly for Black, Latinx populations to vote, that it will make it more possible that there will be charges of fraud when someone makes a mistake because they're voting the same way they voted for years and suddenly they're wrong.
There is simply no question, Amy. That's exactly what's going on. Donald Trump is promoting a big lie. And there's a lot of folks who are saying, well, yeah, he's the former president. He's been called out as a liar. We know that. We know that. But the fact is, he's succeeding in state after state after state. Republican officials, many of whom in the past stood up to him or at least didn't go along with him on everything, are falling into line. They are supporting these bogus audits. And as you point out, they are supporting election and voter suppression strategies that, if implemented, will make it dramatically easier for the Republicans to upend election results or to impact election results in 2024. This is a big deal, and people have to refocus on the whole of this story, refocus on Donald Trump's clear sedition, his efforts to overturn an election result, and refocus on how to, A, avert the voter suppression strategies, and that's something that Congress can do by endorsing the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, but also to hold Trump to account. It is absurd to suggest, as we learn more and more about Donald Trump's personal engagement in dramatic abuses of office, that Congress does not revisit these issues, and frankly, that state officials do not revisit these issues as well.
We just have 30 seconds. The John Eastman memo, the significance of it?
It lays out the strategy that was being examined in 2020, and it tells us what will be done in 2024 if action is not taken to hold Donald Trump to account and to avert voter suppression.
We want to thank you, John Nichols. There's much more to talk about with you. We'll have you back on the nation's National Affairs correspondent, and we'll link to your piece at democracynow.org. And we end today's show. We send condolences to our producer, John Hamilton, on the death of his father, William Billy Selden Hamilton, a professor of Slavic languages and linguistics, spent nearly three decades as assistant dean of the college at Wake Forest University. Also, a longtime bluegrass musician, was affectionately known as Banjo. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two positions, a director of finance administration and a human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzdor, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tami Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen Honey, Masood and Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Marion Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
And you are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. Listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio broadcasting for 61 years, thanks to listeners just like you. Consider becoming a sustaining member of the radio station or a regular member. Call our pledge line. It is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Call that number, 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Support Democracy Now! Support WBAI.